The Farm in the Countryside podcast is brought to you by Pivot BioProven. Get what you paid for. The nitrogen that stays put, weather or not. Learn more at pivotbio.com. Welcome to Farming the Countryside. I'm Andrew McCray. They are called Paniolos. It's the special name for the cowboys of Hawaii. The story of cattle on the islands is an interesting one. Part of that tale involved a young man named Parker who jumped ship and became friends with the king. We visit with a cowboy who once rode herd on the 130,000-acre Parker Ranch. It's our story for this week's Farming the Countryside, brought to you by Pivot BioProven. It's time to rethink nitrogen. Pivot BioProven replaces nitrogen fertilizer with microbes that adhere to the crop's root system and apply nitrogen each day. 2019 performance report data shows Pivot BioProven consistently outperforms synthetic nitrogen fertilizer year over year, providing corn growers improved yields and a more dependable nitrogen supply that isn't lost to the environment. To read the performance report, go to pivotbio.com. And for more information on Pivot BioProven, text PROVEN to 31313. Earlier this year, before the COVID travel bans, we hosted a Farm Journal listener trip to Hawaii. While I was on the Big Island, I had a chance to do an interview I have long wanted to get. I've always been fascinated with the story of cattle and cowboys in the Hawaiian Islands. Some of you will know that the Parker Ranch has a long history in the islands and is one of the largest ranches in the world. It's over 130,000 acres, cover a lot of ground on the Big Island. I sat down with Robbie Hind, who once oversaw the herds at the Parker Ranch. Today he has slowed down a bit, but he's still managing his own smaller herd on what is actually the southernmost ranch in the U.S., on the southern tip of the Big Island. Robbie not only knows the story of the Parker Ranch, but tells the tale of how cattle came to Hawaii and how the Parkers became such a large cattle ranching operation. Here's the story of the cowboys of Hawaii, the Paniolos.
I'm fifth generation here in Hawaii. The original Hind came from England in the mid-1800s. I'm basically a cowboy. I've raised cattle all my life and been part of the Paniolo culture here in Hawaii for all my life.
Talk about that word for just a second, because a lot of mainland people won't even know what that is.
Well, Paniolo, in the 1820s, cattle had been introduced in the late 1700s, 1793, I think the first cattle arrived in Hawaii. And the king at the time, King Kamehameha I, put a kapu on them, or a tabu. You couldn't hurt them. And so the population in that 30-year period was starting to overrun the population, their taro patches and everything. And the king at the time, King Kamehameha III, said, we have to do something. And he sent for some California Spanish vaqueros to come out and teach the Hawaiians how to handle these critters. And so they were the first folks to come out here. And they were called Spaniards, but the Hawaiians pronounced it a little differently, and it came out Paniolo. And so that's where we get the word Paniolo.
Your family, then, is back five generations. When they came here, though, they came with sugar before they got over to the cattle. Is that right?
That's correct. My great-great-grandfather came out from England, and he built sugar mills. And it was the happening thing then. And he started on Maui and built a bunch on Maui, the island of Maui, and then came to the Big Island and built some in North Kohala, with the north part of this island, and realized, hey, I can do this for myself, and ended up acquiring some land and becoming one of the sugar folks. So,
your great-grandfather then, though, got into the livestock, is that right?
Yeah, my great-grandfather, Robert Hind, the name kept carrying down. I've received five generations of the same name, but he was in charge of all the mules and stuff that they used to haul the cane and whatnot and work the fields. And in 1893, he said, you know, I've had enough of this. I want to branch out and do something on my own. So he went and leased some property from the government at the time and started Puva'ava'a Ranch. And that's where I get my cowboy roots from, is from him starting that cattle operation there. Boa.
You mentioned leasing the land. As we go back that far, how were they handling land? Or even today, is, you know, in the mainland, we buy a property. But here, how did that work over time?
Prior to 1847, no foreigners could own land here. And so it was a kingdom of Hawaii. Anything prior to that would have to be done through the government at the time. In 1893, he leased property from the territory of Hawaii at the time. It was the Republic of Hawaii, but it wasn't a state at the time. He had a partner. They leased 100,000 acres at the time and started a ranch called Pu'awa Ranch. They eventually bought fee simple land on a portion of it, but the majority, and that was about 1,200 acres, but the majority of the ranch was a lease and always was from the government.
People can't see this since it's radio. You kind of talk about the grazing land here, you will, and the stocking rates and so forth. This isn't like you're going to find about anywhere else.
Yeah. Of course, we're a volcano, right? We're grazing on a volcano. On the island of Hawaii, which we're talking about, there's so many different types of terrain on this island. I mean, we've got the older part of the island that was the older volcanoes, and that land has turned into more dirt kind of country, so better country for agriculture. Then you get to the south part of the island, and that's where the new volcanoes are and the more active ones, and basically active today. And they're spreading lava, you know, every once in a while. And so you have a real cross-section of land. And down where my great-grandfather leased was a lot of lava. And so it was rough country. It took a lot more effort because in those days there was, you know, no water system. They had to develop their own water. And cattle had to be hardy because you know, most of it was lava that they grazed on. And but in those days, they brought in grasses. They planted grass, and they tried to improve the land as much as they could. I remember when later on, when I was a kid, how these bulldozers would drag big anchor chains between them and smash the lava with the anchor chains and make it smoother so that, you know, horses and cattle could run on it. Otherwise, it was tough. And, you know, talking about horses, the first horse arrived here, by the way, in 1803. The horses, you could not bring a horse from the mainland, at least in South Kona or where our ranch was at the time, and expect it to be at all productive because it would not know how to go over the lava. But if it was raised there, it knew how to get along with the lava, and you could have a working horse. But you bring something else from the mainland, and poor thing wouldn't last very long.
I wanted to get into that because we use horses on our farm. But how do you, this terrain, there's places where I don't see how you get a horse over it, and how do they learn to get over it?
Well, and I'll go back to when they were first brought here. You remember the cattle were brought in 1793 as a gift to the king. And George Vancouver, he was a British captain, and brought the first cattle here. And the king was so impressed, this is King Kamehameha I, that he created a 400-acre paddock with rock walls. And that's where these cattle were kept, and they were protected. The first horses came 10 years later in 1803, and he protected them also, and they multiplied. And so you've got the cattle multiplying in one area and the horses multiplying. And then, as I mentioned earlier, King Kamehameha III in 1823 or mid-1820s said, we have to do something. Because at that point, there were something like 20,000 head of cattle, and they were running rampant all over the countryside, and they needed control. And so he sent for those Mexican vaqueros to come over and Spanish vaqueros come over and teach the Hawaiians basically how to raise cattle. And that thing, by bringing over those Spanish vaqueros, it started a culture here. It started the Hawaiian cattle culture, Paniolo culture, and it's got a great history to it. The cattle, there were no fences in those days, only rock walls. You know, they had a lot of rocks to deal to make fences with. So they would build, they would fence off, you know, areas that they didn't want the cattle to be in. They would fence the cattle out. It was a different concept, right? Mm-hmm. So after the vaqueros got here, then they started fencing cattle in versus out. But yeah, that was the start of cattle being raised. When John Palmer Parker, you know, started the Parker Ranch, his family was in the shipping business back east, New England. You know, during the early 1800s, when all this stuff was going on, he was 19 years old and went on a trip because there was a lot of trade being done between Hawaii and Asia. And a lot of it was sandalwood. I mean, there was tons of sandalwood that was raised, you know, grew up on these mountains here in Hawaii. And the Chinese loved the sandalwood for lining their chests and all kinds of stuff because it had a good smell to it. And so it was a real commodity. And the ships would come to Hawaii and to resupply, load sandalwood, and then go trade with China and then come back and forth. And John Palmer Parker, the first, saw Hawaii, came right here to this Kauai High, the harbor, and resupplied, got some sandalwood, went to China, and was stuck there. There was some revolution going on and was stuck there for a couple of years. And when he came back through Hawaii on the way home, he jumped ship, and they sailed home without him. And so he's, 20 years old, young guy, and here on the island of Hawaii in 1817 or whenever it was early on, 1816, 1817. Not a lot of white folks lived here. It was mostly Hawaiians. And he made friends with the king and the ali'i, and they thought he was quite a novelty, you know. and he eventually married the king's granddaughter, which helped him. And the king hired, he had a musket, he had brought a musket and some stuff, and he started hunting the wild cattle and supplying ships with salt beef. That was his main job for the king, and the king liked it because he was getting some revenue, and so that's how Parker got involved in the cattle business. But at the start, it was strictly a harvesting situation. And so King Kamehameha I died in 1819, and so, of course, John Parker was already here. And when he married the king's granddaughter, he got a small plot of land up, it's called Mana is the area, and that's the name of the homestead, and built his home up there and raised his family, started raising his family. And of course, in the mid-1820s is when the vaqueros came over. And he was part of that whole thing, you know, showing them where to go and what to do. And eventually, in 1847, he started raising cattle, but it was all in royal land, right? But in 1847, when they passed the law that said, you know, non-Hawaiians could own land, that's when he started expanding his operation. And of course, when he passed away, his son John II took over, and eventually the Parker Ranch ended up being 400,000 acres.
At that time, what were they doing with all that livestock? Just supplying the ships and supplying native ships. People then?
Yep, supplying the ships and hides. They would sell the hides. So basically it was for the meat and for the hides, but nothing organized. It was more of a harvesting kind of a thing. Eventually, Park Ranch brought in better genetics. They'd bring in Hereford bulls from England, and they had the biggest Hereford herd in the world in the 20s, 1920s and whatnot. So, and this would be in the 20s, you know, 1920s. And remember, there was a war that came, and Park Ranch played a big role in after Pearl Harbor was bombed in the early 40s. And there were, I can't remember how many Marines that were stationed here on the ranch. It was, gosh, I think it was something like 20,000 Marines were stationed here gearing up for Iwo Jima when they did that battle. The ranch would kill so many head a week to supply, you know, the needs for the military. anyway, a lot of history here.
So you're going to have a connection with the Parker Ranch. Tell me how that develops, because your family had a ranch, but you're going to end up working for the Parker Ranch for several years.
Remember, my family sold Puyallawa Ranch, and I was raised in South Kona at a portion of that ranch that my dad managed. But my dad got a job at a ranch in South Kona called McCandless Ranch and managed that for those folks. And that's where I was basically raised and learned all my cowboying and everything at that ranch. So I went to college on the mainland, majored in business, and would come back in summers and cowboy during the summers or work construction, either one. Eventually, I graduated from college, came home, and started a real estate company and hated it. I would tell the people all the thing that was wrong with the property and didn't do a good job selling. So my partner said, "Rob, you know, why don't you go back to ranching and I'll take this over from now." So that's where I went. And I went back to McCandless, where I was raised, and became a cowboy. And eventually I worked my way up and became the manager of McCandless Ranch. And out of the blue, I got a call from the business manager at Parker Ranch. And I'd known him a little bit, but not well. And he said, "Robbie, would you be interested in working for us?" And I said, "In what capacity?" And he said, "As livestock manager." And I told him, I said, "Sure." In the meantime, I called my dad. I said, "Dad, Parker Ranch just called." And I said, I wanted to get your opinion on this, because they had gone through a number of managers prior to that phone call, and managers lasted about 2 to 3 years, and then they would change and get a new group in. And, you know, I had a little 2-year-old daughter, and my wife was pregnant with our second child. And I said, "You know, I don't want to, I'm very comfortable here. I'm, you know, it's challenging. It's a great job. But, you know," and my dad goes, "Are you crazy?" He goes, "You take that job. I don't care if you last 1 week." He said, "It's going to be an experience." And so I said, "Okay." So in December of 1984, I started at Parker Ranch.
You were head of all livestock operations there then?
Yeah, I went from a herd of 1,500 cows and 8 employees to 20,000 cows and 75 employees. Bingo. But you know, one of the greatest things was I didn't know anybody on the ranch. I mean, I knew a few of the cowboys and had, you know, roped in rodeos and things with them, but I didn't know any of the politics or anything that went on. And so it's probably the best thing for me, because when I got here, I could look at things very objectively and go, "Why are we doing it this way?"
About how many acres was it at that time then?
It was 220,000 acres.
And so then what could you stock that at, or did it vary a lot by where?
Okay. Really varied. In fact, we had 2 different breeding seasons because of we had 2 seasons. So we had a spring calving and a fall calving deal. In the best country, we could raise 1 animal unit per acre. Very productive. Uh-huh. And then you had areas that were 1 to 10, 1 to 15 per acre, which compared to New Mexico or something, that's still really good.
Yeah, it is.
But it was just that, you know, it was a real difference in what you could raise and where you raised it.
So what about feed out here? Is it totally grass, or what else do you have? Because there's not a lot of corn growing out here on the island.
During Mr. Carter's time, A.W. Carter, in the 20s, 30s, and 40s, they raised a lot of corn on Parker Ranch. It was all dryland farming, and it was done up in, it's an area called Waikea, which is up on the side of Mauna Kea, and they produced corn. And today you'll still see the corn silos that they have and corn cribs, and they'd all by wagon and horse, and they'd haul the corn to various divisions and feed their cattle, or they had pigs. They raised pigs and turkeys and all kinds of stuff. So yeah, we did raise some corn, actually, dryland farming. But basically it was grass. And different seasons, different areas where the grass would grow, you know, better. It's one season when we had rain and stuff. So it gave you a lot of flexibility, you know, on that.
But were you moving those cattle quite a bit then to follow the grass?
Yeah, or we'd make sure that they were not raising a calf when it was dry in that that area. And so, and they'd be wanting to raise calves and be breeding back when they had their rains and stuff. So it just depended on where. And if some place got in trouble one year, then we'd shift cattle and whatnot. The biggest thing was Mr. Carter developed it was water system. Without water, you're not going to raise a lot of cattle. And in the wetter side of the ranch, you had springs and streams that would run mostly year round. But most of the ranch is, you know, no streams or water. So what they do is they make reservoirs at the bottom of some drainages. And when you have a big event, reservoirs would fill up and you'd have water for a while. Well, when the water got run, you'd have to move your cattle to where there'd be water. So that was a real, and that's before my time, of course. But then Mr. Carter came and he developed a system where we collect water up in the Kohala Mountains, which is, you know, a real rain. We got 80 inches of rain a year up there or more. And he made some waterheads and ran a pipeline all the way across the valley here to Mauna Kea. And then we had a pump system that lifted water up to 7,000 feet and then gravity, you know, the whole thing. Huh. And so
you talked about the genetics a century ago were Herefords. So what genetics did you have when you were there? What grows well on the islands?
Okay. When I first got to Park Ranch, they were trying a four-way cross. And there was the Herefords, of course, which was the majority of the ranch. They had Brangus, they had Angus, and they had Shorthorn. This was a four-way cross developed by a guy named Ensminger. And he was a professor. I can't remember what University of Washington, Washington State or something. Anyway, and they were following this. They wanted to, because of the hybrid vigor and everything you get out of the crossbreeding, right? Crossbreeding was the big thing then. So eventually I worked to get a Angus herd, so all our cows were black. And in the Angus breed, I was able to find genetics that were so separate. I mean, such a huge genetic pool that you could get genetics from one side and genetics from the other side and get some hybrid vigor out of that. And so today, they still are doing the same thing. They've got, it's an Angus herd based. But the only thing is, when we were shipping cattle to Canada feed, the Canadians loved the Charley crosses. And so I said, okay, let's take our older cows, who are bigger framed and whatnot, and we'll breed Charley bulls to them, and all their calves would go to market. We don't keep any females because it'd be too big for our country. That's when we were shipping a lot of cattle to Canada, and they loved them as feeders. You know, those Angus Charley crosses were, they feed really well, and we made good money on them. And so today they're doing the same thing.
The cattle then that are raised here on the islands, whether it's Parker or other ranches today, are any fed out here, or does everything go to the mainland? And if they do, then what weight are you sending them? And most go to Canada or West Coast in the States or where?
Okay, and remember, I'm just talking about Parker because that was more my niche of the thing. But remember, there were a lot of ranches in Hawaii. I mean, there were big ranches, you know, 1,500 cow herd, nothing compared to Parker. But, you know, there was a lot of ranching going on in the, when I was growing up, you know, in the 50s, 60s. Okay, in the 50s, and this was after the war, the continental U.S. had a lot of corn. And they wanted to, you know, add value to it. So they started running it through cattle. And the same thing happened here. Except up there, they built the feedlots near the corn. Over here, we're 2,500 miles away from the coast, not to mention the Midwest. So we ended up opening a feed yard to take care of Park Ranch cattle as well as other producers. And but we had to import all the grain, so our cost was higher. But our product was fresh, and the supermarkets liked it, and all the markets. And so we got, and at the time, we had a packing plant there in Honolulu. This was all on Oahu, on that island, where the population was. And we'd ship our calves to Honolulu, put them in the feed yard, finish them. They'd be processed there, and then carcasses would be delivered to these markets, and they'd break them down and market them. And it worked. And this was 1950. Well, when I arrived in 1984, and this is industry-wide, right? I mean, everybody fed their cattle. Everything stayed in Hawaii. But what happened, cryovac packaging and fabricating, box beef, came into play. All of a sudden, the supermarkets said, wait, we can get a cryovac steak without being frozen from the mainland here and have 60 days shelf life. So we want you guys to fabricate the carcass. We don't want to do that anymore. So all of a sudden, we looked at, you know, shipping, and there were cattle boats all over the world, these ships that ship cattle, sheep, everywhere, all over the world. So they're there. So I called this one company, Coral Line, original, right, Danish flag vessel, and talked to them, and I said, can you ship cattle from Hawaii to the mainland, you know, continental U.S.? And they said, sure, we can do that. And we went to a board meeting at Hawaii Meat Company, which was that side of the business, right? And I remember him standing there and saying, we have a plan that we're going to try. And he explained it to him. We're going to send 4,000 steers to Canada, and we're going to run them through a process, you know, the whole process there, and we're going to get results. So that's what happened, and the ship arrived at Kwaihai down here. We loaded 4,000, well, it was two trips. They did a 2,000 and 2,000 and sent them all up there, and we had a veterinarian on board to make sure the animal, you know, check, make sure their health, and we hired a Canadian company out of the University of British Columbia to do a study for us. So they had a guy ride with them and, you know, take all the data, went to the mainland. We sent them in April. They got up there, went out to pasture, stayed there until October, and then went to the feed yards, and they were, you know, they're dead at the end of the year, first year. And we made more money on those cattle than we had been making on, you know, keeping them here. Yeah. And that was the light, bing, went on. And so after that, this was in the 90s, we shipped 10,000 head a year we still kept some, but eventually the packing plant closed down.
And today, all cattle on a Y basis, are there any little locker plants that you can slaughter something here if you want?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. So, but your cows and bulls were still here. And today, you know, grass-fed animals are real, you know, it's a trendy thing, right? And so a lot of our production on, you know, with ranches, not only Parker, are staying here and marking locally as grass-fed animals, which is good. You know, our carbon footprint, or hoof print, I should say, was huge when we'd send them to the mainland, bring them back as a steak. I mean, you know, not real good. But today, a lot of cattle stay back in Hawaii and are used, you know, grass-fed animals. Right. And remember, we only produce, I think it's 6% of the beef consumed in Hawaii. I think Hawaii ranchers produce about 6%. There's a huge market here.
Well, I wanted to wind up with a couple questions like this with the Hawaii cattleman. Mm-hmm. How do you see the market here? Because it is certainly different than almost any other state. Is the market for raising grass-fed beef in Hawaii, is that what the consumer wants here? And is there a market for that? Or how do ranchers here look at it?
It's a niche market. And I think it's popular today because it's we're not, you know, feeding corn to cattle has never been real looked at as a good use of corn. But the majority of people are still buying choice cattle from Costco and all over. And so I think if we can build that grass-fed market, that's great. And if we end up keeping everything that's produced in Hawaii here to fill a grass-fed market, that would be wonderful. But if we can't, we're still going to have to ship some cattle away. And of course, you know, your cows and bulls still become hamburger and sold locally. But I would hope that would be something that would happen.
What are the other big issues cattlemen face here that we may not think of in the mainland?
Well, you know, we're out here in the middle of the Pacific, and we're lucky we don't have, you know, winters. We don't have to put up hay. So that's the good news. But if we have a drought and it affects the whole island or the whole state, we just don't throw cattle in trucks and move them to another state. So that's the part that can get real dicey. And, you know, we've had some pretty heavy droughts and lost cattle and whatnot. But, you know, you can bring containers of feed until you have no more money left, and they're going to die. You know, so, you know, when you think about it, there's no other real big agricultural crop other than grass that, you know, a ruminant animal can survive on. So
talk about your ranch today. You have, you believe, the southernmost ranch in the U.S. Is that right?
Yeah. My mom and dad formed this ranch right about the same time that I mentioned the Hine family sold Pu'awa Ranch, the family ranch. And they bought just a small little, I think it was 50 acres at the start, down South Point. Growing up, it was always my dad's ranch. You know, I worked for other ranches and stuff, but it was always my dad, and he had a partner. And it was his deal, and we would go down and help brand and stuff, but it was never got involved in it. But eventually, they got a lease that was 15,000 acres and from a big landowner. And it was perfect because we were surrounded by it. And we ended up running cattle on about 5,000 acres of that. The rest of it was lava. So we had our ranch was probably, you know, a little over between 5,000 and 6,000 acres. And we ran 1,200 mother cows. And when my dad passed away, I was still at Parker. And I can run it from afar, but we still need to some cowboys and whatnot. And they said, Rob, whatever you think, you know, and so, which was good. And then Parker Ranch, this was in early 2000, they came up with an early retirement program. And, you know, I wasn't going to do it. And then I started thinking about it, going, you know, I'm 55 years old at the time, or whatever I was in my mid-50s. And I said, you know, maybe I should take advantage of this. And they were very generous with the package and everything. And so I took the early retirement. Then I took over managing my family's ranch. And, you know, so after running 22,000 mother cows, yeah, I can, 1,200 is like, you know, doing my sleep. Anyway.
If you go to the Big Island, you can travel to the town of Waimea, headquarters for the Parker Ranch. You'll find the town looks similar to many small towns you might find in the Intermountain West. The Parker Ranch does have a visitor center where you can see some of the history of their operation. Plus, if you enjoy ranching and even exploring the islands by horseback, there are ranches offering tours on several islands these days. A great way to explore firsthand some of the Hawaiian cattle culture. Remember, you not only can hear stories like these on our Farm in the Countryside podcast, but follow American Countryside on your local radio station or on Facebook for our daily features about interesting people and places like Robbie. Thanks for listening. I'll catch you next time on Farming the Countryside. The Farming the Countryside podcast is brought to you by Pivot BioProven. Get what you paid for, the nitrogen that stays put, weather or not. Learn more at pivotbio.com.